Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen. Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo are here as well, of course. On this Thursday, August 25th, 2011, news happening today. The Libyan rebels are trying to get after Gaddafi and see if they can gain total control of Libya. Meanwhile, here in the United States on the East Coast, Hurricane Irene working her way up the East Coast, pointing directly at New York City and New England. But the big news this week is in the financial sector, where gold hit nearly $1,900 an ounce before plummeting back down to $1,750, due very likely to central bank initiatives, probably at the behest of the central bank with J.P. Morgan involved, although we don't know that 100% for sure. And then this day, today, Thursday, was up another 20 points, so it kind of reversed direction. That may be only the beginning, though, because of the actions of one Hugo Chavez from Venezuela, who, well, I'll let Jake tell us a story about what Mr. Chavez has been doing. Jake?
Right. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has ordered the central bank to repatriate $11 billion worth of gold reserves, which are held in countries such as the Bank of England and other banks in the United States, such as J.P. Morgan, Chase. And this is very significant. Venezuela is not only one of the world's top producers of gold, but it is also has one of the largest gold reserves with 365 tons. However, 211 tons is held abroad, and that's what's being called back. Other banks include Barclays and Standard Chartered PLC, which holds Venezuelan gold. So the Bank of England will be returning it. Chavez also nationalized the country's gold mining industry, I guess for the second official announcement, taking over all the gold mining companies. And he has also announced that he is diversifying Venezuela's cash reserves that were currently held in U.S. and European banks, and he's now shifting them to countries that include Brazil, China, India, Russia, and South Africa. So this is a pretty major move. And I guess, you know, from our interviews and with the work done by GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Group, the most significant thing will be really if, you know, number one, will all this actual physical metal get returned? It probably will, but at what cost? Because a lot of these banks have leased out the metal in exchange for paper currency or government bonds and stocks and the like. And for them to have to go out and repurchase it at very, very much higher prices is going to be you know, fairly damaging. And the paper market in gold is roughly, you know, at least it's a very paper market. So you've got some estimates say that for every 1 ounce of actual physical gold, you have another 100 ounces of paper gold out there circulating. So it'll be interesting to see in some investment vehicles. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Gold, again, has shot up over the last 6 weeks from $1,500 to $1,900 per troy ounce. It was shot back down over the last couple days down to $1,700, where it bounced up and I believe finished the day at right about $1,770.
Jake, are you saying that, okay, the gold he wants to get back from the European banks and various sources, it's being hailed for him, but he actually has to pay to re-own it, I guess?
Well, he's just moving it back. Now, what was most likely happening was either, I don't know the exact details, but either he lent it to the banks to lease out, or he's just paying them to actually physically store it at their banks.
But it is actually his.
The information that's publicly available doesn't say. But again, the major thing is this is a very large amount of gold to be moved back out of the U.S. and London system, since most of the gold the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve Bank each hold about 6,000 metric tons, but most of that is for other countries, not for England or the U.S. And obviously, you know, there's probably somewhere in Chavez's mind is probably the idea that the U.S. or the English could confiscate his gold, and he's moving it back. And I would say that's probably, you know, with the rise in gold price, it's probably something meaningful to do, but also the fact that he is moving all of his liquid paper currency funds out of the West and moving that into the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, and China, I think is also significant.
Yeah, I agree. It's amazing.
It is significant, and what's more, it could be the very first step, because once Venezuela takes their gold back, then the question becomes how many other countries, how many other central banks start taking their gold back. And the more gold gets repatriated to the countries that own them, it becomes more and more difficult to cover any kind of gold leasing arrangements that have been surreptitiously going on. Because like Jake intimated, and as Gata has been claiming for many years, the various central banks of the world have been engaging in a sort of a fractional gold system without telling anybody, of course. And that causes problems because, as Jake pointed out, if the Bank of England or say, J.P. Morgan or the Fed or one of the other major central banks has to start buying gold from the market in order to cover its obligations, that's going to just drive the price tremendously up. Because up until now, remember, most of the short selling has happened because of actions by the central banks of the world, particularly the U.S. Central Bank and the European Central Banks. And if that changes, if they become net buyers, that means there are no buyers left. I'm sorry, there are no sellers left. So if there are no sellers left, that means you're just driving the price up, 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 up. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the weeks and months ahead. Is gold going to go through a skyrocket that will dwarf anything that is done to date?
And really, it's certainly possible. And, you know, like you said, we've covered on our show the Thai central bank buying gold, the South Korean central bank buying gold for the first time since the Asian financial crisis in 1998. So the trend is definitely going towards nations trying to seek their insurance for their paper currencies. And, you know, here in the United States, we're left with Ben Bernanke, who very recently said under testimony that the only reason that central banks hold it is for tradition. And the price of gold is probably embarrassing him. So we'll be hearing from Mr. Bernanke out of Jackson Hole tomorrow at 10 a.m., where he will be talking on the subject of the near-term prospects for the economy out of Jackson Hole, the same place where he announced QE, the quantitative easing 2, I guess last year, was it?
Yeah, poor guy has to go all the way to Jackson Hole and suffer there.
And as you point out, Jake, a lot of banks are engaging in this kind of activity. In fact, Kazakhstan, this past week, they announced plans to, quote, lock up domestic supplies of refined gold by using a priority right. This is a right that it receives from the government to buy bullion designated for exports amid record prices for the metal. So one more central bank, again, a smaller one, but nevertheless one more central bank doing what they can to try to get their hands on the gold. And I guess apparently this showcase that is a kind of a nice little asset to hold, really behind the scenes is money. And they just haven't told Ben Bernanke yet. Well, we have a guest coming up, and so we're going to actually break a little bit early here. Very interesting guest. This is a guest, it's a father and daughter, Robert Fernandez and his daughter, Luciana, are going to be joining us to talk about efforts that they have been involved with to try to fight back against the various local authorities around the country who have gotten rather negative news lately by trying to shut down lemonade stands. Very interesting story, so you want to join us for that. Plus, we're going to be going into some of the other news stories of interest, including the fact that Governor Rick Perry of Texas is now the Republican front runner. We're also going to be looking at what's going on with food stamps and a whole bunch more, so you want to stay tuned for all that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we are going to be back after these messages here on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Last week on The Green Firm.
You know, I have to think that we are on some kind of collision course with this ridiculous dismissal of science at such a high level. People running for the highest office in the land, proudly declaring they don't believe science. I mean, say that again. Would you ignore 98% of doctors who told you you had a serious illness and had a prescription for how to, if not cure, then treat it? I don't think so. I mean, let's just, you know, stop this nonsense.
Yeah, give up your cell phone and your iPods and all the other things that science has brought you and see how that works out for you.
On the Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 p.m. or anytime on the archives on Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network is the home for progressive minds. It's the place where progressives get together to discuss important topics with informed opinions, minus the agenda. PRN is the place for fresh, stimulating, commercial-free radio content from leading progressives all over the world every day. The Progressive Radio Network, making the world a more informed place, one mind at a time.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cunning.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Yeah, run back to that radio dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. And to introduce our guest this week, I'm going to turn things over to Jake Town. Jake?
Sure. Today we have Robert Fernandez and his daughter, Luciana. Robert is the father of two, and he was the organizer of the nationwide Lemonade Freedom Day, which was just held last Saturday on August the 20th of this year. Robert and his daughter, they'll be joining us to tell us, you know, why he organized this event and how it went. Robert and Luciana, are you with us?
Yes, we are.
Hey, how's everything going?
Good. How are you, Jake?
Very good. Very good. Hey, first of all, I guess for our listeners, you know, why was this Lemonade Freedom Day so important, and why did you guys decide to hold it?
Well, basically, we decided to do it. I was looking through the news, and I came across all the stories of the lemonade stands that were shut down, mostly because of permits or safety issues. So I looked into it, and I saw, you know, report after report of different shutdown. So, you know, I said, you know, there's something we have to do about this. So, you know, I came up with the idea of Lemonade Freedom Day. And when I came up with the idea, I figured, you know, let's try to get people nationwide to go out and set up lemonade stands. And what better way to show support for lemonade stands than just having thousands of lemonade stands across the country? So, you know, I basically went out and put up the website. I sent it to about 100 or so Facebook friends that I have. And before I knew it, I had thousands of people signing up and showing interest. I had calls from media outlets all across the country, radio interviews. I was just on Fox News. It's taken off way more than I ever expected.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, for, I believe, what states held lemonade stands that day? Was it just New Jersey, Pennsylvania, D.C., California? Were there a bunch of others?
Well, those were the major groups that set them up. I had a few groups of individuals that contacted me, and they said they wanted to do their own group thing in support of the event. So they kind of set up their own groups and did the groups, but there were individuals all across the country that were doing them on their own. I received a lot of reports via email and via Facebook of you know, individuals, you know, parents, children that just went out and set up the lemonade stands, and they had no issues at all. The only issues were the participants in Washington D.C., where there were three people that were arrested for setting up the lemonade stand on the west lawn of the Capitol building.
Now, is that a felony or misdemeanor?
I believe it's a misdemeanor, and there's a code issue there or something like that. But they were released without any bail or anything like that. So I don't think there's any jail time involved. But they have a court case coming up next month. I'm not sure exact the date, but I'm planning to head out there and go down to the court date with them.
Yeah, that just kind of shows that the property of the state sure doesn't belong to the rest of us.
But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you had mentioned, you know, a lot of things are getting shut down, like, you know, the police want business license, permits, food permits, and all this other stuff just to sell, you know, this lemonade stuff that you just mix with water and vend. You know, I would say that most of the police officers themselves, you know, back in the day might have, you know, easily had this type of operation themselves going on. What do you think is kind of going on, you know, right now that is leading, you know, our country's police or local authorities to kind of crack down on this type of trying to sell something to other people?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's just, you know, overreaching government as always. You know, it's you know, I believe that we need to be left alone, that business needs to be left alone, that the free market needs to be the free market. And, you know, not only with children, I believe that, you know, with adults as well, you know, I mean, if you look at all the problems with the economy that we're having and all the problems with unemployment and everything that we're having in this country, it's a pretty clear sign that there's issues here. You know, you have people complaining that you know, corporations and big business are outsourcing to other countries, and they're complaining about it and yelling, telling the government to do something about it. But really, the government is the problem, and it's because of all this regulation. You know, they're running out of the country to escape all of the overregulation and the taxes and all the crazy laws that they have to, you know, abide by. There's so much of their resources that go into compliance issues instead of going into a final product and the service that they want to deliver to their customers. So, you know, it's a clear warning signal, you know. And as far as the kids are concerned, I think that, you know, you want to one of my goals on this is also to get children to start thinking for themselves without having to ask the government for permission for things. You know, get them out of that mind, start questioning these laws, because you know, some of these laws are so ridiculous, and they're so they're causing so many problems in the country. So, you know, we don't want the children growing up, you know, just blindly, complacently following these laws without asking questions. We want them to ask questions. We want them to say, you know, why do we have this law? Why? It doesn't make sense, you know. So instead of following, you know, question these things, and maybe, you know, being that they are our future, then maybe they can make some changes.
Right. Yeah, Luciana, do you think that selling lemonade is a crime?
No.
Yeah, I don't think they should be throwing anybody in jail or fining anybody for trying to go out there and, you know, sell a product to other people. I remember when I was a kid growing up, they had these things called Jolly Ranchers. And I don't know if they're still around, but it was just a sugary candy, and I'd buy them in bulk, and I'd sell them at school during lunchtime. And over, you know, a few months, I was able to make, you know, a couple hundred bucks or whatever. And, you know,
wow.
The kids got what they wanted. I got what I wanted. I was able to, you know, do whatever the heck I wanted with that $300, which was a lot of money back in the day. It wasn't, it's not nearly so much now. But I think that you kind of hit upon a very important point, Robert, because, you know, these kids grow up, they see, you know, just the idea of, you know, seeing other kids and parents, you know, not allowed to sell things, whether it's lemonade or newspapers or whatever, and that they have to grow up in this little square box and then go work for a big corporation, go work for somebody else is pretty silly. You know,
point.
These folks, it's a great way to learn how to run a small business, and it's kind of interfering with kids' dreams and telling them what they can and cannot do, and that certainly is not the role of government. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I agree with you, Jake. I mean, and the other thing is too is you know, do you want to give them that message that they can't do anything without permission? You're squashing their dreams. When you take a small child and they have their dreams of creating a lemonade stand, however small that may seem to us, to them it's a huge dream, and it's a goal that they set, and then they go with the goal, and then they follow the goal through. So it's teaching them to follow their goals, to follow it through. It's teaching them about money. It's teaching them about commerce. It's teaching them about being productive members of society and providing a service or a good for society, and in return receiving something back for it. So it's showing them how the system works, how it's supposed to work at least, you know, and by telling them, no, you can't have this lemonade stand, you know, and then when they grow older, you know, they start thinking, well, maybe I'm not allowed to do this, maybe I shouldn't do it, maybe it's not good that I do this, is this a bad thing, you know, and to me, that's not what you want to teach these kids. You know, I'm convinced that if it was up to the government, we'd probably still be living by candlelight instead of having electricity.
You're probably right. I've got a couple questions for Luciana. Luciana, am I correct in assuming that you also have a lemonade stand of your own?
Yes.
You do? Okay. And you've been selling lemonade. How's that been working out for you?
Well, it was good.
Yeah? Making a lot of sales?
Yes.
Yeah? What do you think of it? Is it something that you've enjoyed doing that you'd want to keep doing?
Well, I think I would still want to do it.
Oh, yeah? Okay. How much were you charging for a cup of lemonade?
$2.
Wow. That's a pretty big glass there, I hope. Talk about inflation. When we had our lemonade stand when I was a kid, it was 5 cents.
Well, just to add to that a little bit, we actually had two different locations. One location was basically a kind of a poor inner city area in Elizabeth where we were trying to raise a little bit of money for a local soup kitchen. And the people in that area don't have a lot of money, so in that area we were charging 25 cents per cup. And if people did not have money, we would just give them a cup of lemonade. So, you know, that's what we were doing in Elizabeth. And then we went to Philly, and the location was a bit different. So we adjusted the prices accordingly for based on our location, and that's where we were charging $2 per cup.
Yeah. Luciana, that sounds like a very smart idea to change the prices to the crowd.
That's right.
Did you ever contact the young girl in Portland, Oregon, that went through the same thing at the street fair?
No, we did not.
Okay. Yeah, she was they called her on food safety, I guess, the inspectors, and she eventually was able to.
Yeah, and that's another, you know, that's another issue that you know that brings that you just brought to mind is the food safety issue. You know, it's this whole concept, this whole idea that people think that the government is the only agency or corporation or organization that would be able to protect us from, you know, the dangers of, you know, food problems and things like that.
Right.
But, you know, as most people know, I mean, you could pretty much talk to anybody. You know, pretty much everything the government does is inefficient, and it doesn't work to the, you know, to our benefit in most cases. And I believe that as well as food safety. I believe that an independent, individually run operation would be able to handle that in the free market better than the government would be.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Lemonade is basically lemons, water, and sugar. So where exactly is the food safety issue?
Well, a lot of the issues that I've noticed looking at some of the reports, they require hand washing stations, and some of the hand washing stations are these like thousands of dollar hand washing stations that need to be available at the location wherever you're vending food or drink.
That's
just one example, and it costs like thousands of dollars to get this hand washing station.
So I guess the danger is that your clients could have sticky fingers, and they could get their stinky fingers all over the walls of the nearest house or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds like a real food safety issue to me. I mean, you know, where's the salmonella? That's what I want to know.
Well, it sounds like a great deal for the company that builds the hand washing machine, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, yeah. I bet they bought off a few politicians to get that type of stuff passed. But yeah, I've encountered that. You know, I have an acquaintance of mine that is putting together a restaurant, and he's trying to sell pizza, and, you know, the place already has all the permits with it. But he has to rip out the grease trap and upgrade it to, I think it's like a 1,000-gallon grease trap, which would dwarf. Like, this isn't a very large place. It's just massive. And it would cost him, like, somewhere in the tens of thousands of dollars to get installed, so he can't go on with his business. But he would have had it maybe in a different township here in Pennsylvania. Maybe he would have been able to build it no problem. So it's pretty silly. It's just another example of all the regulations and stuff that government has put into our lives that is really cutting down on people's happiness, and also doesn't really create any. There's really to no purpose. I mean,
well,
if someone were to be poisoned
what
or whatever, that can be dealt with separately. That's why we have courts and that sort of thing.
Well, what it does is limit competition. It creates a barrier to entry, and prices go up.
It also gives the politicians an opportunity to micromanage, which, of course, is how they continue to get reelected, because if you continue to micromanage and, tell everybody what to do, then you can say to the voters, hey, look at all these wonderful things I did.
Oh, absolutely. And again, with the competition, I mean, you bring up the different requirements, thousands of dollars, $10,000 for, the heat vent or whatever it was that you mentioned, and things like that the competition is gone, because you're basically doing away with the small mom and pop shops that can't afford to do these expensive, costly upgrades to their restaurant or to their place of business. So now you're left with I believe that that's one of the reasons why we only see these big box stores like the Walmarts and the Targets all over the
exactly.
place anymore, because there's no way a mom and pop can compete in this environment.
So when do you become a franchise and start doing Lemonade or Us?
To be honest with you, I don't even like lemonade.
We're trying to sell a product.
Do you lemon drink
Luciana,
or lemonade?
Do you plan to do this again next summer?
I'm sorry, she didn't hear you.
Oh, sorry, Luciana, do you plan to do this open up in a lemonade stand again next summer?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that should be a lot of fun.
What about expanding and doing, smoothies or something?
Yes.
There you go.
Ah, okay.
We actually sold, last year she wanted a swing set. So, I came home and I told her, I said, I'm going to have you do chores, and we'll give you money for the chores so you can save up and get your swing set, because I'm not going to pay for your swing set. And then she came up with the idea on her own. She said, hey, Daddy, how about we make some cookies and you can sell them at your office? I said, I'll help you make the cookies if you want to make them, but you're going to have to come to the office and sell them. So she did, and she ended up making enough money to buy a used swing set on eBay. So that's what we ended up getting. And she did it with her cookies that she made, and she went out and sold them, and she got the list of how many cookies to make. And, we sat down and figured out the math of how we're going to do this, and so she learned a lesson while doing this about math. She learned a lesson about about economics, about business, and about getting something that she wanted. So it's a great lesson for kids.
Good for you, Luciana. Congratulations on reaching your goal. That must have been really exciting.
Thank you.
Are you
thinking of
hiring employees?
Try that again.
How's the swing set?
How was the swing set?
It's good.
Is it what you hoped it would be?
Was it what you hoped it would be?
Mm-hmm.
See, this is the kind of person we need running for political office. The answers are short, sweet, and to the point.
And they're truthful, yeah.
And truthful.
I'll vote for you.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us. We're actually running a little bit short here because we've been going through this so quickly, but are there any last thoughts that you want to leave with the audience before we sign off for this particular interview?
Well, I'm sure, yeah. I just want to let everybody know, that children are naturally, they're curious, they're creative, they come up with these ideas, and I think it's important to let children follow their dreams. As a parent, your job is to be the guide, and not to stop them from doing things that they want to do. I think that's it's one of the worst things you could do for kids is tell them not to do something that they really want to do. If there's danger involved, of course, being the parent, it's your responsibility not to let them do something like that. But as far as something like setting up a lemonade stand or something like that, I think it's a great thing. It's a great way for them to learn math. They can learn so much more about math and economics and business than they can sitting in a classroom. So just let them have a lemonade stand. You know, if the police officers or the county or anybody tells you not to do it, always question them. And especially if you're on your own property, I would say just go ahead and do it anyway. If, you know, if worse comes to worse, if they ask you to shut it down, then just shut it down. But, you know, document everything and you know, put it out there. The more people see these things going on, the more people start reacting to it.
Well, congratulations on the success of Lemonade Freedom Day, which I guess was held on August 20th. Is that correct?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, August 20th. So congratulations on pulling that off. Are you planning to do it again next year?
Yes, we do plan on doing it. Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay. So this could become an annual event. Very good. And Luciana, congratulations on achieving your goal of the swing set, and hope that your next round, your lemonade stand round two, is even more successful than the last one.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on the program. Robert Fernandez, daughter Luciana, thank you once again. And we're going to take another break and then come back to finish up with the headlines. This is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yeah, run right back, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always find out what the latest and greatest is in terms of who our upcoming guests are by visiting our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. If you had visited the site during the past week, you would have seen that Robert and Luciana were going to be on, and we have a guest coming on next week. I won't even tell you who it is. I'm going to make you go to the website to find out who's going to be joining us next week. But you'll want to tune in and check it out, because it's going to be a very fascinating guest that will be on the program with us next week. Getting back to the news, we're going to take a look at what's going on with the Republican presidential nomination race, and there's a new frontrunner there. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, has moved into the lead, and Gene DiNardo has some very interesting information about that, specifically about what's being known as the Texas Miracle. Gene, what are the details of that?
Well, basically, this just extrapolates on what you brought up last week, Walt, but I did have a kind of a humorous quote I got from a Kevin Carson article that I'd like to read to you guys, or paraphrase anyway. And what he opens his article, he says, "When I watch two intellectually challenged Ken Doll politicians," he's referring to Mitt Romney and Rick Perry, "with perfect executive style hair, I really realize just how much I miss Dan Quayle." And he also described Mitt Romney as born on third base and thinks he hit a triple, which I think is an old saying. But the article goes on to say that Rick Perry has leapfrogged to the top tier of the Republican presidential candidates largely on the strength of one compelling fact. During more than a decade as governor, his state created more than 1 million jobs, while the nation as a whole lost 1.4 million. Perry says that the Texas miracle rests on conservative pillars, that he would bring to the White House minimal regulation in government, low taxes, and a determination to limit the reach of Uncle Sam. What he does not say is that much of the job growth has come because of government, not in spite of it. With a young and fast-growing population, a large and expanding military presence, and an influx of federal stimulus money, the number of government jobs in Texas has grown at more than double the rate of private sector employment in Texas. The disparity has grown even sharper since the national recession hit between December 2007 and last June. Private sector employment in Texas declined by 0.6%, which is pretty usual for the rest of the country also, while public sector jobs increased by 6.4%, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. Overall, government employees account for one-sixth of the workers in Texas. Analysts call the growth in government employment in Texas a national consequence of the state's surging population, which has grown by more than 20% in the past decade to 25.1 million. That increase has caused local governments and school systems to hire teachers, budget analysts, compliance officers, policemen, etc. The growth in government jobs may shortly come to an abrupt halt when state budget cuts take effect later this year. The Texas economy also has benefited from huge sums spent by the federal government. The state is home to several large military installations, as well as NASA, which helped Texas reap more than $227 billion in federal spending in 2009, more than double its 2001 total. Texas is the nation's second most populous state behind California, where the federal government spent almost $346 billion. In the wake of the global economic downturn, the state has raked in nearly $25 billion in federal stimulus money, which has gone to everything from road projects, etc., also helping to balance the state budget. Befitting its population, Texas has received the third highest amount of stimulus money in the nation, behind California and New York.
I suppose it doesn't hurt to have a few thousand oil wells as well.
Yeah, I think the oil wells help.
Just a little bit. Maybe that's part of the Perry platform, to put an oil well in every city.
In every home.
In every home. A chicken in every pot and an oil well in every backyard.
In every backyard.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, the last thing he mentions is there has been a trade-off because of the approach, the conservative approach, I guess you say, we're limiting what the state does. Many educators and others say the trade-off is evident in many social indicators. More than a quarter of the state's population lacks health care. I think we covered that last week. It also says Texas is last in the country when it comes to the number of adults with high school diploma. It is 44th in the country in school spending per pupil, and its rate of income inequality is ninth highest in the country. And this, I think, is the worst, not because of the minimum wage, but it says 9.5% of the Texas workforce is paid at or below the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, tying it with Mississippi for the largest share of minimum wage workers in the country. Now, I think any time you're tied with Mississippi, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, the real question is how many of those are illegal immigrants, and of course that's a big issue with Governor Perry.
That's another good question, right?
Well,
but I just
wait
to show that, you know, politicians will twist the facts and the figures and you know, say they're doing one thing when they're doing another. And
I'll tell you what I'm waiting for with Rick Perry. I'm waiting for him to actually say something more than a soundbite.
I agree.
Because so far he hasn't said anything substantial other than to basically swear at the Federal Reserve and make it look like he actually knew what he was talking about. But he hasn't really said anything that shows he really does know what he's talking about. He's just uttered a lot of typical conservative platitudes, so that's about it. I mean, that seems to be the basis of his platform so far.
Yeah, and did he ever explain? He never said anything about the Federal Reserve other than calling it a treat. He never explained his position is what I'm saying. Did he?
I don't think he ever has. I mean, his position seems to be, well, there it is, and of course that's the way it should be, right?
Exactly. I think you know, you really need to explain these things, because when normal people or average people hear you say something about the Federal Reserve, they do view it as a soundbite. They say, oh, it's just another crazy person talking about the Federal Reserve. But when you're more like Ron Paul, where you explain your position.
Yeah, that makes a big difference.
It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Along the lines of political parties, I was going to go to a different story after this, but this kind of falls into it. So, Jake, I'm going to kind of catch you unawares here. The Republicans and Democrats are not the only political parties who run candidates every year. And Jake has some interesting information about what might happen with third parties in 2012.
Right. The Wall Street Journal just published an article yesterday about the poll was done to expect a third-party candidate to run for president in 2012. And they point out Ross Perot's presidential campaign in 1992 and John Anderson in 1980 that got a decent amount of support. And a new Rasmussen Reports poll conducted earlier this month found that just 17% of likely U.S. voters think that the federal government today has the consent of the governed. I think that's a pretty shocking figure. 17%. Now, again, you have to actually go out and find those people, but that's only 17% of the entire society. Well, an extraordinary...
Well, they're all living in
Texas. Right. 69% of them believe that the government does not have the consent. So just, and I guess there's maybe 5% that don't know.
Yeah.
But a poll of 1,000 Americans has been conducted by a different polling company, found that a solid majority are now looking for alternatives to the two-party system. 57% of all respondents said there is a dire need for a third party. And more of half of the voters favored having a third major political party. So there's a lot of things that have kind of been moving slowly in the past few years and are kind of picking up now. And, you know, we talk about on the show about a lot of the things that Bush, the second, was elected for, he didn't follow through on, namely to have a humble foreign policy. Certainly ended up doing the exact opposite. And then when you have Obama elected in there to end the wars and do all these other things, stop torture, obviously none of that happened. People are still being tortured. Guantanamo Bay is still open. CIA can still do whatever the heck they want. And we have not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but we have military actions ongoing in Libya. And also we're doing some bombing in the country of Yemen. So not exactly living up to his campaign promises.
Have you guys heard about the Democrats for Ron Paul movement?
Yeah, the Blue Republicans.
Blue Republicans, exactly. And basically what you're saying, Jake, that they think Ron Paul will actually carry out what Obama, you know, promised to carry out and didn't.
Of course, that's the one thing about a third-party candidate. You have to have somebody emerging as a strong third-party candidate. That's what happened with Ross Perot in 1992. So if the Wall Street Journal article is correct, that means there's got to be somebody who's going to emerge. Do they have any idea who that might be, Jake?
They don't mention in the article. They're pretty much just saying that there are the conditions are ripe for something like that. The one person, actually the only person that they mention in the entire article is Donald Trump. And again, he was rumbling that he might be running for the Republican nomination. Now he's rumbling that maybe he'll run as an independent. But I guess that would sort of fit into the Ross Perot mold in being able to finance the campaign due to their financial assets. But
Ross Perot with better hair.
I'm not sure I can picture Donald Trump doing charts.
I mean, no, not exactly that. I just mean the ability to break into the double digits and then the polls and that sort of thing. So,
but he's pretty much associated with the status quo. I mean, that's one thing Ross Perot kind of had. He had sort of like this maverick side to him. But Donald Trump, does he have a maverick side to him?
Well, not that I know, but it would just be another rich guy kind of running things from my point of view. But it's interesting that Gene brought up the phrase Blue Republicans, and so I think I'll spoil our next week's show a little bit. We'll be having a reporter on, Robin Koiner, who coined the term Blue Republicans about Democrats who are going to temporarily register as Republicans in order to vote for Ron Paul in the 2012 GOP primary. And we'll ask him, why he thinks that's a good idea. Why should Democrats and independents go to all the trouble to vote for a Republican? So
he gave away the secret. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Well, you can read a little bit more in some of his articles on freedomnewshour.com.
Have you guys heard the online convention that's going
to
happen?
Online convention?
Yeah, there's an online convention, and this is apparently pretty big. They were saying they can only start in certain states for some regulation or reason, and they've already gotten a million people involved in California, and everything's going to be online, and they're going to nominate a candidate. You know, all the states will come together online. There'll be representatives just like they do it in the big house, and they'll come up with a candidate, and it'll be on the ballot.
I guess it's not quite the same thing, though, as a regular convention where you have the convention chair for each of the states go up to announce the vote totals, because on the Internet it's all instantaneous. Boom, up, well, there it is.
There it is.
Takes all the drama out of it. Well, getting back to drama of the more economic kind, of course, that's really the big issue that's going to be dominating the 2012 election. That is the economy itself, and a lot of people are hurting because of that economy. Among those who are hurting are the people who are at the poorest end of the spectrum. And, Jake, you have a very timely story for us about what's going on with food stamp recipients.
Right. The USDA, the federal government, provides the SNAP program for food stamps to Americans that qualify. And for the last several months, they haven't, they've omitted updating any figures, but very recently, I popped up on their website the figures as of May 2011, and they are pretty shocking. They're continuing to rise, and there are now 45.8 million Americans living off of food stamps today, which with a population of 307 million is about 15% of the population is now living off of food stamps. And it's the jobless keep increasing, and the governments just keep tacking more rules on, like Robert and Luciana were telling us. And at the end of the day, they wonder why people aren't working.
Absolutely.
Why people can't afford their to put food on the table. And, the government kind of steps in there and provides it. But again, there's no such thing as a free lunch, in this case, literally so. And that money is coming from elsewhere in the society.
That's true. And, Gene, the bad news doesn't stop there where the economy is concerned, does it?
No, the signs, the recent signs aren't too good. The only thing that's really going up is prices. The cost of living climbed more than forecast in July, which could make it harder for Chairman Bernanke to persuade his colleagues to immediately act to spur growth, because that would, push it up even further. The consumer price index rose 0.5% from June. The Labor Department reported Thursday that's more than twice the 0.2% expected by economists surveyed by Bloomberg News. Surveyed by the Federal Reserve Bank, so the other shows that manufacturing in the Mid-Atlantic region contracted in August by the most in more than 2 years. The steep drop on top of a smaller decline in a New York Fed survey this week means U.S. manufacturing probably contracted in August. It would be the first decline since July of 2009, a worrisome sign because manufacturing has been a key source of U.S. growth in the 2 years since economists say the recession ended. Home sales fell also in July for the third time in 4 months. They dropped 3.5% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.6 million homes, and this is really unusual for July. That's far below the 6 million homes that economists say must be sold to sustain a healthy housing market. How they come up with that number, it's really, you know, who knows. The Labor Department said the average number of workers filling applications for jobless benefits over the past 4 weeks dropped to 402,000, the lowest since April 16th. But the weekly readings, which tend to be more volatile, showed claims climbed by 9,000 to 408,000 in the period that ended on the 13th. And then again, it says the consumer prices were pushed higher by rising costs for fuel that have since retreated and by an increase in food costs. Excluding energy and food prices, which are usually more volatile, the core gauge, at least according to the government, rose 0.2%, pushing the increase over the past year to a greater than projected 1.8%, was the biggest 12-month gain in over a year. Which is interesting, you know, let me read this. It goes on to say that consumer price results included a jump in rents, which is certainly true around here, the biggest component of CPI, and increases in apparel, tobacco, and medicines. Mounting foreclosures are reducing home ownership while boosting demand for rental housing. But what I was going to say, it's just so contradictory to logic to have prices being forced up while, you know, everything else is going down, employment, and people are having hard times, and, you know, this just makes it harder. And we've talked about that so many times, I guess. But.
And, in fact, it ties into something that I kind of talked about very briefly in last week's show, but I didn't get to go into more fully. I want to go into it here right now. This is a speech that was given by Alistair MacLeod at the GATA event a couple weeks ago in London, GATA being, of course, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee. And I just want to read a few excerpts from the speech because it really touches very, very closely on what you were just talking about there, Gene, the fact that in bad times the prices continue to go up, and yet there's all this talk about a threat of an ongoing deflation. And he goes into quite a bit of good detail about that. He starts off by saying, I'm going to give you an overview of what is happening to money, because money, of course, is the basis of it. And his conclusion is that we're all heading for a collapse of paper money, or to put it another way, we're heading for hyperinflation. I'm going to skip through it, and he says, Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, devised a way of satisfying his social priorities for economic means, avoiding the excesses of communism. So it was that the 19th century, which enjoyed rising prosperity and falling prices, the result of free markets, was followed by a century of growing monetary inflation, government inflation, and the destruction of savings, which is the result of Keynesian economics. He then went on to quote Ludwig von Mises, the Austrian economist, saying, just as the sound money policy of the gold standard went hand in hand with liberalism, free trade, capitalism, and peace, so is inflation part and parcel of imperialism, militarism, protectionism, statism, and socialism. He could have written that today. We wage wars against regimes that don't share our values. We protect large companies and whole industries from competition with regulation and government support. We turn to the state to solve all our problems, and we are overwhelmingly dependent on socialist welfare. Now, he actually wrote this in the 1920s. At the time of the German inflation, Germany had its own version of Keynes. His name was George Knapp. He preached that money is what government says it is. Money is a government product. Government is sovereign and free to do what it wants to with money. Sounds familiar. Central bankers tell us that printing money to offset stagnant bank lending will bring mild inflation to stimulate consumption and stop a slide into deflation, he says. But not only is this wishful thinking, it is extremely inflationary. It ignores the fact that money and bank credit are used differently. Narrow money buys everyday items, while bank credit is required to sustain asset prices. But without the support of newly printed money, the banks would be insolvent. Remember, they are geared to 10 to 20 times their core capital. In other words, they lend out far more than they actually have in core capital. So it takes very little contraction of lending, very few bad debts to wipe the banks out. And this is the reason that central banks have to keep shoveling in the money to keep the banks solvent. Now, getting to the question of deflation and inflation, this is where his talk gets really interesting. First, he had a slideshow that he was showing, and obviously we can't show the slideshow here. But he showed a chart that was basically a graph where it kind of flowed like a waterfall. You could actually see it starting up high and then just kind of fell off the cliff, so to speak. And this is a graph that represents the price of just about everything in sound money. Now, that's the key words there, sound money, because what he was doing is he was measuring the price of everything in terms of the price of gold. Then he went on to say, the first thing to say is that that price in sound money, I expect prices of all goods and assets to continue to fall very sharply. The chart is of dollar prices converted into sound money. The correlation is not perfect because sound money is not actually used for transactions, but you can deflate anything you like by this exponential line. He shows the line on the graph. Bread, clothes, motor cars, energy. In real terms, prices are sliding at an increasing rate. And he says, I'll come back to this in a moment. Then he showed a second slide. The second slide, again, I'll try to describe it to you. This is a slide labeled nominal U.S. GDP and adjusted for true money supply. So, again, it shows a graph, and you can see the graph basically representing how prices have been going up, and you see a peak around 2008, and there's a little bit of a dip, and it's going up again. And then below that, there's a second line, and the second line kind of just hovers on the same level. It kind of goes up a little bit leading up to 2008, and then it comes back down to the line again. It's like an overall change going on in the overall GDP for the economy. Again, this is GDP measured in true money supply. And what he's actually showing is when you measure the GDP compared to gold, the economy over the last couple of years has actually contracted by about 12%. That makes sense. That matches up with what we've actually experienced. So here we have a period where prices seemingly have stayed normal, but when you measure it against gold, prices have actually fallen by 12%. And then he shows one last graph. This is a graph, the second one's for the U.S. This is a graph for the U.K. over the same period. And starting around 2003, when you measure in real money, when you measure gold prices against the value of gold, what you see is a contraction. You actually see prices declining throughout that entire period on this graph. It's a very interesting graph. His conclusion, and I'll just read what he's saying here in his conclusion. He says, if you take out the increase in cash and non-interest-bearing deposits, Britain has been in recession since 2003-2004. Since 2003, we are down over 20%. I know this analysis is crude, but the message is clear. In real money terms, we are already in a deflationary slump. So, he says, I completely agree with the deflationists, but what they seem to miss is that priced in paper money, prices can, have, and will rise. In Reichsmark, between 1915 and 1922, the GDP statistics would have shown Germany was growing strongly, but adjusted properly for monetary inflation, the economy was actually collapsing. Very interesting point. And unfortunately, I've used up the time here on the Freedom News Hour, so we'll have to pick it up again next week. Jake and Dean?
Yeah, well, it was also very interesting, you know, right after he finished that speech in London, that the riots broke out, mainly with young males robbing stores all over the place.
Interesting coincidence. Yes. Totally unrelated, of course.
Right.
But Jake and Dean, it's been a pleasure. We'll have to pick it up again next week.
Okay, we'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Stay free, everyone. Bye.